I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Now it's time for a special fifth anniversary edition of The Barbershop. That's where the guys talk about what's in the news and what's on their minds. And while we usually end the week in the shop, we knew we couldn't get our anniversary party started without the guys. They've given us 5 years of great buzz, sharp wit, and more than a few cutting comments. So joining us for this round are some of the OGs, our original guys in the shop. Freelance journalist Jimmy Israel made a special trip. He's in our Washington, D.C. studios this week. Hi, Jimmy. Nice to see you sitting right there.
Hey, Michelle. How you doing?
Also with us, civil rights attorney Arsalan Iftikhar, Lester Spence, blogger and political science professor at Johns Hopkins University. And joining us from the West Coast, as usual, syndicated columnist Ruben Navarrete in San Diego. Take it away, Jimmy.
Thanks, Michelle. Fellas, welcome to the shop. How we doing?
Hey,
happy
hey,
anniversary.
Hey.
Oh, shucky ducky.
All right, you know, so it's been 5 years, and we're going to do a little looking back. 5 years ago, Kim Kardashian only had been married once. Senator Hillary Clinton was leading Senator Barack Obama in early polls for the Democratic presidential nomination, and almost no one had lost their job for saying something stupid on Twitter. I even had almost 3 feet of hair 5 years ago. Ladies and gentlemen, those were heady times, and we've come a long way. Now, we're going to go and talk about some of those stories that stuck with us. Right, Michelle?
Well, you know, Jimmy, why don't we start with you, since you did us the honor of coming all this way. What's your top shop story?
For me, Michelle, it has to be the Beer Summit. That was in 2009 after Harvard professor Henry Louis Skip Gates was caught by the police when he forced his way into his own house near campus. He was arrested for disorderly conduct by Officer James Crowley. Now, things really took off after President Obama said the police acted stupidly. Well, that made a lot of people mad. Eventually, the president invited Gates and Crowley over to the White House to smooth things over. Wow, I wish he invited me over. I got mad about stuff anyway.
But why does this matter? That's interesting. This is the one that stands out for you.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's one of my favorite stories because it's kind of an American photograph. You know, because for me, everybody involved was kind of right, but everybody involved was kind of wrong. You know, I mean, it was a great American picture about the confluence of miscommunication, happenstance, and tone right. deafness complicated by race. That's why I love this story. Professor Spence, chime in, man.
So the story, first I remember cracking a joke. I remember when Michael Vick was going through his stuff and I talked about how maybe he should be on the cover of Cat Fancy.
That's not nice.
But the story that jumped out at me was the Newt Gingrich story. We talked about his comments about poverty and about how poor kids should perhaps learn to be janitors and should maybe take over the janitorial services of their high school.
And why do you think why is that the most important one for you?
It's important for me for a couple of levels, for a couple of reasons. One reason is because a lot of listeners don't necessarily, you know, so because we're trying to jam a lot of stuff into like a little bit, there's often a lot of intensity that doesn't get necessary cover. And I felt pretty intensely about the story, but I wasn't able to articulate that. That's the first thing. But the second, the reason I felt so intense about it is because we finally begun talking about poverty, begun to take poverty seriously, but the way that conservatives of both parties, the way blacks and whites are talking about it is really deeply, deeply problematic, right? So since, in 2010, 27 out of every 100 families who needed assistance, only 27 out of 100 actually get it, which means that there are 73 out of 100 families who need assistance, some type of welfare assistance, but don't get it. The reason that kids are poor isn't because they don't have work ethics, right? But time after time, we get this repeated in this current election cycle by conservative Republicans, but every now and then by people like Bill Cosby and even Barack Obama in some cases.
Okay. Interesting. All right. Excellent.
Well, you know, as barbershop listeners around the country will know, from time to time, I tend to hand out my weekly Redunculus Awards. And, you know, the span of 5 years, we've talked about many, many high-profile falls from grace. So we had Elliot Spitzer, we had Anthony Weiner, but for me, you know, the whole Tiger Woods phenomenon / scandal was something that I don't think that we've really ever seen in modern sports history. I mean, you know, here you had a figure who was essentially a transformational, transcendental figure in the sports world. I mean, Nike had entire ad campaigns with little kids from around the world saying, "I am Tiger Woods, I am Tiger Woods." And, you know, he broke the color barrier within golf, essentially, you know, dominated to the point where people were already asking, is he going to be the greatest golfer ever? And then, you know, we obviously had that infamous, you know, incident with his Escalade and his wife taking a 9-iron to it. And I think it really, really shows, you know, a cautionary tale in terms of how far hubris will take you in this world. And, you know, his inability to essentially fess up beforehand and then have his little staged press conference and things like that. And the fact that he hasn't been able to return to form at all, winning a major tournament in golf. I think for me, you know, not only does Tiger win the 5-year Redunculus Award, but it's probably one of the biggest Whiskey Tango Foxtrot moments we've had.
What does that make you say? I don't want to be that famous.
Yeah.
Or I mean, I never want to be that arrogant.
Now the answer, be careful with that answer.
No, I never want to be that famous. I mean, I think that, you know, we as a nation tend to gravitate around a cult of celebrity now, whether that celebrity is based on you being a reality television star or a sports athlete or a elected congressperson. You know, I think that, you know, we've essentially entered into a societal realm of hubris and impunity where essentially, you know, people aren't taking responsibility for their actions.
All right. Well, changing gears just a bit. Ruben, the R.
Yo.
Now, you're always giving us a taste of that West Coast wisdom. And for your favorite story, you went right for the White House, right? Isn't that right, Michelle?
He did. And Ruben, let me play this clip just in case, for those who may have missed it. A few months after the so-called beer summit that Jimmy was talking about, you tied that summit to a couple of other stories about President Obama. That summer, he lobbied unsuccessfully for the 2016 Summer Olympics to come to Chicago. And in the middle of all that, this tragedy unfolded in Chicago that we also talked a lot about. This young student, Darian Albert, was beaten to death on his way home from school in September. He was an innocent bystander. He was literally just trying to get home. And Ruben, here's some of what you said.
A lot of folks were saying, listen, if you bring the Olympics to Chicago, there's no doubt you're going to have lots of police and National Guard protecting the folks here, the tourists, the international tourists. How about spending some money to protect the folks here now before the Olympics get here? And I think it's a very fair point. And the most cutting thing I heard, and I got to hand it to African-Americans are a lot like Latinos in that regard. When they have a question, when they have a concern, they will tell you. They don't care, black president or no black president. They will go right there. And clearly one person said, you suppose the president now is going to invite Darian Albert's mother to the White House for a beer?
Yikes.
Ouch. So Ruben, go ahead.
That was very telling for me and for a couple of reasons. I mean, it has to be said that along with the opposition to Barack Obama from the beginning and from folks out there, some of whom were motivated by racism and some of whom were motivated by other things, who had a very steep learning curve in terms of getting used to the idea of a black president, so did African-Americans have to get used to the idea of what it meant to have a black president. I think basic assumptions were made by African-Americans. I've never said out loud that somehow if you had a black president and you had a case like this from Chicago, the very least you would have is the African-American president would come forward in a public statement and make something public about it. And maybe as eloquent as Barack Obama has been before, as he was in Philadelphia during the campaign talking about race, he could come forward and say something really profound about black-on-black violence, you know? And it didn't happen. And if you looked at the time on some of the commentary on the route where Jimmy Wright and others were saying this in the black community, there was a real concern here that what have we done here? We have a black president who is sort of president first and black secondary. And it took some getting used to. It still takes some getting used to. I think a lot of people in the liberal coalition that helped elect Barack Obama, be it gays or African-Americans or Latinos or civil libertarians or whatever, likewise feel this kind of sense of disillusionment about Obama. They still much prefer him, let me be clear, to the alternative, to Mitt Romney and the Republicans. But boy, they're just not really sure what they got in the bargain. And that came out in this summit, this whole thing about the beer summit and this thing about Darian Albert, because I think a lot of people were – that was the beginning of sort of like, oh, okay, I get it. This is – he's got a really important job. Maybe he doesn't have – maybe this isn't part of his bailiwick. It should be.
What would you have had him do? I mean
– Well, as I said in that piece, here on the Trayvon Martin case. In the Trayvon Martin case, you have Obama getting criticism from both sides because white folks and others are saying it was bizarre for him to come forward and say if I had a son, he would look like Trayvon. And African Americans and others are saying, is that the best you can do? That was this vague statement you made.
Wait a second.
What does that mean?
His name is Barack Obama, not Bruce Wayne, brother. I mean, what exactly? I mean, you still haven't.
The president has the bully pulpit. First of all, Jimmy.
Okay.
He has a moral authority in issues like this. It goes back to when President Kennedy was talking about the civil rights movement or LBJ or anything. When you have presidents at a time of moral crisis, they have traditionally come forward and had something to say. Bill Clinton after the Oklahoma City bombing. But I don't have a moment like that for Barack Obama. I can't point to a case where people have been hurting and he opened up and he made them feel better. I have not seen that.
Tucson shooting after Gabrielle Gifford's assassination.
I don't remember that. I don't remember a single thing he said.
Would your cable went out that week, bro?
I don't remember a single line from that speech. I don't remember a single thing he said there.
Dr. Spence?
You know what? I think I don't actually agree with Ruben often, but I think he's, although the Trayvon Martin incident is the bad example, I understand what he's saying. I think that, and what happened in the Trayvon Martin case is, to the extent that people were critical, and I was one of them, people expected him to actually say something a little bit quicker than what he did, right? But he hasn't been. While he's been really forthcoming and being critical of black communities, right?
He hasn't quite
been forthcoming enough in speaking to black people's ills, other than saying, well, if I help everybody else, I'll help black people. And that's something that I think, to be fair, black communities are used to, right? But that's something that people who are a little bit further to the left of black people, black leftists, so to speak, actually want him to do more than that.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. We're having our special fifth anniversary edition of The Barbershop. Our guests are political science professor Lester Spence. That's who was speaking just now. Also with us, attorneys and author Arsalan Iftikhar, and our writers Jimmy Israel and Ruben Navarrete. Back to you, Jimmy.
All right. Okay. Well, The Barbershop, we've hit the big five. And so we're going to go around the table with some of the OGs, the original guys, talk about some of their favorite memorable conversations. And now political science professor Dr. Spence is up, and we're going to talk. You know, we're not surprised, probably, by your standout story. So it was political, I'm sure, right, Michelle?
Yeah. Well, he already talked to us about the Gingrich story, but why don't you just pick another one? You talked about one of the moments where you talked about Newt Gingrich talking about sort of poor kids. Well, is that the most important political story for you over the last 5 years? What would you pick?
It really is, because, and this goes back to Ruben's comments, right? There is a way that we've talked. There was a moment in time in which the poor were kind of taken off the radar, particularly after Bill Clinton passes the welfare repeal in essence, right? But then when all of a sudden the poverty numbers just jump up, we're having this conversation again, but how do we talk about it? There is this group of people now who talk more about structural inequality, but at the same time, there are a number of people who over and over again basically blame the poor for their circumstances.
Well, let me ask you this. Next 5 years, just quick, we only have about 3 minutes left, and we want to hear from everybody. Next 5 years, Do you fear you'll still be having that conversation?
Yes, but the thing that'll be really different, this is something I never expected. You'll increasingly hear us talk about white poor as if they were black. Right? And that's something I thought that the poverty thing would just be about black people, right? But we'll see them talk about the white poor the same way they talk about black people.
Ruben, how about you? What do you think? Next 5 years, what do you think?
I think to Lester's point, and the bigger point, yeah, some of the things we're dealing with now are going to continue on for the next 5 years, and unfortunately probably the next 50 years. We're going to find different ways of talking about those things, but the idea of sort of caring about people who are going through something you're not going through, getting middle-class folks to care about poor folks, getting rich folks to care about the price of gas for middle-class folks, it's very difficult. Mm-hmm. It's not going away.
Arsalan?
For me, you know, what's interesting during the 2008 presidential campaign, when, you know, people on one hand tried to paint then candidate President Obama as some sort of crypto Muslim Manchurian candidate, and then during the Jeremiah Wright debacle, he was a Christian liberation theologist. You know, it's like pick a lane. You got to slow your roll there. But you know, the otherizing of each other in politics, I think that's a good phrase. Because, you know, essentially, by, you know, 22% of Alabama, Mississippi voters right now in 2010 believe that Barack Obama is a Muslim, and essentially that's their way of saying he's black. That that's their way of otherizing him. And, you know, now that we have a Mormon candidate on the Republican side, I hope we're going to, God willing, see less of that. And then hopefully in 5 years, we'll have our own television show for the barbershop, so we'll be able to talk about it on the air.
Right. Nice save, nice save. Let me just say that that's Republican voters, Mississippi's Republican voters. A majority of those believe that Obama was. That's who was surveyed. Just want to be clear about that. Jimmy, fine.
I'm hoping in the next 5 years, me and my homegirl Margaret Bernstein from The Plain Dealer were talking about the fatherlessness thing as it impacts the black community. I really want us to start talking about how the lack of fathers in the home has impacted our community as a whole, and how we can work on that, how we can fix it. Also, I want us to have conversation about education, you know, and public school education. Why do I have to pay $15,000 a year for my kid to get a decent education? You know, why can't the school system rise to the occasion? You know, I want to hear those conversations in the next 5 years.
Well, back to Dr. Spence's point,
right.
The whole question of the father and the role of the father in home is not a black problem anymore. It's not just a black issue anymore. This is one of those areas in which, more broadly, the single female-headed households have become a dominant family style in the United States.
But I think it hits our communities the hardest. I do.
Okay, fair point. Jimmy Israel, freelance journalist and presidential fellow at Case Western Reserve University here in Washington, D.C. for our special fifth anniversary edition of The Barbershop. Also with us, Lester Spence, blogger and political science professor at Johns Hopkins University, Arsalan Iftikhar, civil rights attorney, author, and founder of TheMuslimGuy.com, all here in Washington, D.C. And from San Diego, Ruben Navarrete, syndicated columnist who writes for The Washington Post Writers Group, Latino Magazine, and CNN.com. Thank you all so much, and happy another five.
Peace.
Thank
you.
Yep.
And that's our program for today. And once a week, we take time for our credits. That's where we recognize the work of the Tell Me More staff. But there are so many others who helped make this program possible, we decided we wanted to share our celebration with them. So all this week, you will be hearing the names of the other talented NPR professionals who are responsible for bringing Tell Me More to you. Today, we are thanking the technical staff at NPR News. That includes Kevin Langley, Chiron Thomas, Marcia Morgan, Tom Woodward, Jim Lesher, Sam Greenspan, Neil Ellis, Michael Cullen, Marty Garrison, Charlie Mayer, and Sean Fox, Norb Gallery, Dennis Herndon, Camille Jefferson, David Williams, and Omar Saul. And special thanks to engineers in our bureaus in New York and Culver City, California. And remember, to tell us more, please go to npr.org and find us under the Programs tab. You can find our podcast there. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Tell Me More NPR. I'm Michelle Martin, and you've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Let's talk more tomorrow.